Our Old Testament scripture this morning is from Exodus 16, verses 11 to 20. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." That evening, quail came and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is it?" For they didn't know what it was. Moses said to them, "It's the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Everyone is to gather as much as they need. Take an omer for each person you have in your tent." The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, the one who gathered much didn't have too much, and the one who gathered little didn't have too little. Everyone had gathered just as much as they needed. Then Moses said to them, "No one is to keep any of it until morning." However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Our New Testament scripture is from 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 10 to 15. "And here is my judgment about what's best for you in this matter. Last year, you were the first not only to give, but also to have the desire to do so. Now finish the work so that your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion of it according to your means. For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what one does not have. Our desire isn't that others might be relieved while you're hard pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. The goal is equality. As it's written, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little." This is the word of the Lord.
Well, good morning, everyone. Why don't you turn around and greet one another and say good morning to each other? It's really good to hear from Lisa and a little bit about the FLC. All sorts of things happen there. I don't think Lisa mentioned the play therapy over there that helps traumatized children work out issues in terms of just playing, interacting with a therapist. We've seen various interactions through heart to heart with children affected by divorce and the difference that makes divorce. And I know with many people who have experienced it, but it's never an easy thing, and there is collateral damage that is done, and again, to be able to minister into those situations. And I was saying, I know Lisa has a real heart for fostering. I don't know if that'll change as new arrivals come along, but I know others in our church have a heart for fostering as well. And I was at a wedding a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to someone who used to work in the rap block, and they were just sharing how their heart was for fostering as well. They weren't a Christian, but they were just saying, you know, the ability to get in at the foundational level and have an influence on young lives. And I just thought, yeah, it's such an important sphere and area. The exciting work that's going on throughout the church makes this series even more difficult, because if you know and you come along on a regular basis, you'll know that February is our stewardship month, where we talk about our use of our money, but also our time as well, and really consider and reflect on where our whole life is, a holistic situation. And I was saying last week, this series is probably one of the hardest series that I've ever had to preach since I've been here at SBC because of the situation and the context that we find ourselves in. We're really facing two dilemmas. The first one is that we've seen a significant drop in our giving, which has created quite a significant deficit for us in terms of this financial year. The reason for that is very simple, that our long-standing members have either been dying or moving on, and the new givers have arrived, but they haven't been giving at the same level as the long-standing members that have moved on, and that's had quite an impact in terms of our finances this year. But it also creates another dilemma for us because we can't go on with a pattern of deficit as we go into the future and as we go into the new financial year. And therefore, we're looking at and contemplating cuts, as you'll see if you read the finance section of this, in the region of £60,000 to £70,000 in terms of our existing budgets. And that will have ramification for our staffing levels within the life of the church. And as you can imagine, that can create real insecurity and angst with the staff. And so we would appreciate your prayers at the moment and appreciate your prayers in terms of the leadership as we navigate this difficult season. And as I say, it's one of the most difficult seasons I've ever had to negotiate since I've been here. And on Friday, I had a kind of day off, and I was walking, and it was a bit insane because the weather was horrible. And as I was walking, I saw this walled garden. I'll take shelter in that walled garden. And I went into this walled garden, and it was a beautiful orchard. And every single one of the trees was beautifully pruned. If you come to my garden, I've got a tree in there, and I don't prune it. And every so often, I have to do something about it, and I kind of hack it to death, and it doesn't produce any fruit for 3 or 4 years, and it's just like terrible. But I looked at this orchard, and I looked at how beautifully it had been pruned, and it reminded me of John 15, where Jesus talks about how his Father is the gardener, and that which he loves, he prunes. And he prunes it not to kill it, like I tend to do with my apple tree, but so it will bear fruit. And what we're facing at the moment is a pruning exercise. But we're pruning not in order to say, everything's finished, woe is us. We're pruning not in order to kill things off. Actually, we still want to have a commitment to our youth and children's work, to our work with FLC, to The Haven, to all the various ministries that we engage in and develop. But we are doing it in order to see a fruitfulness as we move into the future. And our vision persists. And we'll talk about buildings next week as we talk about that. So that's the context for this series, and it's a different context from the ones that we normally have at this time in February. I have chosen to speak from 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and chapter 9 over these weeks because these are chapters that deal most with the principle of giving. What's happening in these letters is that Paul is addressing the need of the church in Judea. And there was a famine happening in Palestine at this time. And the church in Jerusalem was suffering severely, and it needed the support of the other churches so it could minister to its wider community, but also sustain its life in Palestine. And so Paul was committed to raising money amongst the churches in Greece and the churches in what is today modern Turkey or Asia Minor, as it was known in the Bible. And the church that was probably the wealthiest out of all of these was the church in Corinth. Phenomenally wealthy. We actually dug up an inscription in the city of Corinth a few years back. And it mentions a guy who appears in the Bible. And it's this guy called Erastus. And the inscription says, Erastus laid this pavement at his own expense in appreciation of his appointment as city treasurer. Okay, this is not some wee tarmac job. What it's saying is Erastus was the guy who looked after all the money in one of the richest cities in the entire empire. This guy is phenomenally wealthy, so much so that he can pay for marbled streets and colonnaded streets in the city of Corinth and leave us an inscription. You know, this guy's a committed Christian. He's mentioned in Romans chapter 16, verse 23. God had to speak to people like Erastus, but there were others as well within that community. And Paul wanted to speak to the whole community in terms of giving and the biblical principles for giving. He lays out in these chapters really a pattern for giving. And he uses the example of the church in Macedonia, which was based in the predominantly in the city of Thessalonica. And he uses their pattern of giving, and he says, look, they gave in the right way. They gave proportionately according to what they had. They gave sacrificially, willing to give things up, and they gave compulsively. We really want to do this. We need to invest in what God is doing. And they had a real desire to give and invest in what God was doing. See, as we read these verses, we see a foundational principle, and it's the principle I want to emphasize over and over again. Basically goes like this. If you don't want to give, please don't give. And that's the principle. That's what Paul says here. I hate it walking along the road between here and M&S. I have to walk home that way because there's all these, I've forgotten the name. What was the name? Chuggers. Yeah, all these chuggers. You know, the people that approach you to try and convince you to sign up for things that you don't really want or need. I remember passing it's like you have to run through this sort of colonnade of them on either side hoping they don't get you. And I remember once I wasn't quite quick enough and one of them got in front of me. And she said, can I speak to you? I don't even know what it was about. And I said, I'm not interested. And she says, I know. That's why I'm here, to make you interested. And I thought, that's actually quite a good response. And I almost talked to her, not quite. But you know, we just hate it. And what Paul's saying is, you should not be giving out of any sense of compulsion. You know, if you don't want to give and you feel you're being compelled to give, then you shouldn't give. You know, sometimes we talk about tithing and the idea of giving 10% of your income. But you know, Paul's not talking here about tithing. And I think he's not talking about tithing because it can create a sense of compulsion. Oh, you have to do this. And also, when you do this, then you tick the box. And it's like you can forget about all the rest of your resources and money. It's like, oh, I've done my bit. And Paul's saying, no, that's not how Christian giving works. And if you feel under compulsion and your heart isn't orientated to give, then please stop giving and get your heart right. It's the same with guilt. You know, my intention in these series is not to generate guilt. I'm not trying to make you feel guilty and ask you to give out of guilt. I think that's a lousy motivator for giving. It's something we're subject to a lot in our culture, isn't it? Adverts that try and make us feel guilty and then give out of that guilt. That's not, again, how the church operates. It's not how Paul invites us to engage with our giving. What Paul says here is, he says, you should have a desire to give. And if you don't have a desire to give, what you need to do is you need to step back from the whole question of giving and you need to look at your heart. And you need to ask, what's going on in my heart? You know, I think there's kind of two aspects to this. And we talked firstly last week, and I encourage you to listen to all of these talks in this series. But the first aspect in terms of our heart is, you know, what's my relationship to Jesus like? You know, what is my priorities in terms of the Lordship of Christ in my life? And do I really love his church or not? You know, where am I at in terms of my love of his people and the mission of those people on earth? Where am I at in relation to that? But there's a second aspect to this as well, which is, you know, what's my relationship to money? You know, what does money signify and how does it engage with my life? And after Paul talks about this foundational principle, he moves on to deal with the second aspect of how we relate to money. And so he moves from the foundational principle, which is if you don't want to give, please don't give, to the second principle, which is balance and proportionality. It's very important that we understand that our giving is not to come out of extremities. And that our relationship to money is actually to reflect balance and proportionality. What I mean by that is we've not to have a poverty and self-denial spirit. Some people get really, really guilty about spending any kind of money on themselves. And they think, oh, God will disapprove of whatever. I want to tell you this morning that I do not believe that is an issue with God. I don't believe God has a problem with us having nice holidays, having nice cars, having nice houses, having any of these things. I don't believe that for God, these are issues. Some people get into a poverty and self-denial kind of mentality, and then they start ending up judging one another. I was telling the other servers, I got a very nice car last year, in fact, this time last year. And just so you know, the nice car didn't cost me any more than a Volkswagen Uno. It just looked expensive, okay? But I did have it, and I wasn't really sure if it was an appropriate car for a minister to be driving around in. I once stopped to fill it up with petrol, and some folks in the church saw me with it, and they said, we didn't realize we had such a cool minister when they saw the car. But I wasn't sure, and I kind of thought there may be an issue when I went to visit one of our members, and I took the car, and I parked around the corner so they didn't see what car I was driving. And then at the end of meeting with them, they offered to give me some books. They piled on all these books. And they said, will I help you carry them to the car? And I was going, no, it's okay. And I struggled with these books to get them to the car so they didn't see what kind of car I had. Just 3 weeks after that, this got hit by a wave coming Taunton Road and got written off. Some people have suggested it was the judgment of God. I'm not sure. But you know, sometimes we get into this mentality that, oh, God doesn't want us to enjoy nice things. That actually it's not okay. And sometimes, you know, it used to annoy me. I'd go to meet with other ministers. And sometimes they would try and make me feel guilty that I led middle-class churches. And it was like, oh, you're not really spiritual, are you? Because, you know, you're not in an urban deprivation area struggling. And I was like, what is that? What is going on here? And yet, sometimes we get to the other excess where we have indulgence and excess. And we never actually moderate or ask ourselves in terms of, are we using our money and our resources in a way that is God-honoring? We're just spending. And then Paul makes it clear here that there are kind of two responses. First of all, that we should not be in want, but that what we give should be in accordance with our resources. And so that what he's saying is there should be proportionate giving in terms of what we have. But secondly, and it's premised on this, if we can go down to slide 10, it's based on that we should honor God. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 9 says, honor the Lord with your wealth and with the best part of everything your land produces. Then he will fill your barns with grain and your vats will overflow with the finest wine. The Bible tells us that we need to commit the first portion of our money to God. Here's the thing. I don't think God has a problem that I bought a nice car. But I think he would have a problem if I buy a nice car at the expense of the things that he calls me to. You see? Because why? That car is starting to displace the priority that God should have in terms of my finances. Now, for a lot of you, this isn't a problem. Many people within our church are generous givers. But I'll tell you where sometimes it becomes a problem is in terms of our time. You see, oftentimes we're quite happy to write checks. You know, and think, okay, I've written a check, tick that box. Now I can get on and do whatever I want with my life. But actually, the call of God is not just this honoring God. It's not just about our money. It's about our whole lives. It's about what we do with our time and our energies. And again, for many of us, we spend our times and energies on various things, some of and most of which are actually really good and positive things. But we fail to honor God with the first portion of our energies and times. We were having a discussion about whether we should use the word volunteering or serving within the life of the church at staff. God calls us to serve, and we're called to serve one another. You know, in the service, for instance, we need people to welcome folks to church. We need people to set up coffee rotas. And you know what? We struggle to get people to do that now. And you kind of say, well, why? Because it's not that demanding. And it's like, well, people don't want to commit to be there 1 week in four. And you go, oh, okay. You know. And then again, well, I want to get judgmental, but then you begin to ask, are we giving the first portion? You know, as a church, I think one of the things that we're facing is, as we recognize that we can't staff for everything, is that we're going to have to move increasingly towards a volunteer culture, towards a culture of service. And that requires all of us to say, we're going to give our energies and times our first portion. Oh, I'll talk more about it next week, but I see Stephen sitting in the front row, so I'll pick on him. But, you know, yesterday I was just going through some emails that Stephen did when he was the chair of the church meeting. And I was just looking at all the resources he provided. And you know, he'd sent them over time. But when I looked at them all together, I thought of the hours and hours. I mean, Stephen used to work in and Maureen as well used to do training. And both of them, the amount of energy and time, if we translated that into money, was remarkable. I hope I don't embarrass you, but, you know, I do want to acknowledge that. And, you know, and that story can be told over and over again within the life of our church. But some of us will write the check, but we won't give our time. And there's a call to service. Now, hear me. You can still have your foreign holidays. You can still have your meals out. You can still, but God says, are you going to honor me? So what stops us doing this? Well, there are various barriers to this giving. And again, I think Paul is listing these in 2 Corinthians 8. He talks about the lack of motivation, what's happening in our hearts. He then talks about a lack of discipline, and he talks about a lack of balance. I want to look at the last two of these, the lack of discipline and the lack of balance. You know, the first one, the inability to turn intent into reality, is a real problem that many of us struggle with. Paul talks about how the church in Corinth, when they first heard about the need in Judea, had said, let's do something about it. And they had started to get focused, and they had probably worked out a plan of how they could raise some money and how they could release some resources. But somewhere along the line, we don't know precisely what, they got distracted. And Paul says in verse 8, you started really well. You know, you started off so good. And then somewhere, you got distracted, and so it's not completed. Some of you all know I've told this story before, but my daughter was in her race, first race when she was like 5 or 6 years of age. And, you know, kids running. I think she was running 50 yards, and all the parents were there and everything, and I wanted my daughter to win. So I had carefully drilled her and trained her to make sure she would win. And the race started, gun goes off, kids start running, 5 or 6 year olds, you know what parents are like in these situations. And then she was out in front, she was leading, it was going great, it was like brilliant. And we thought we would capture this moment by taking a photograph. We didn't have mobile phones in this day, we had to use cameras, and we were going to take a photograph. And my daughter, who had just had this intuitive sense of being photographed at any moment in time, decided to stop, turn around, and have her photograph taken, by which she was then passed by all these other people. And you were like, ah! What happened? You got distracted. You started well, you had great intentions, and somehow you got distracted. See, that's often what happens with our giving. We you know, we sit and hear a sermon like this, and we go to church and we say, yeah, we definitely need to review our giving before God and see what God's saying to us. And by the way, if God's saying to you what you're giving is great and it's fine, then please don't be disobedient to what God is saying. But if God's saying, you know, well, there are some areas that maybe you need to think about, then please be obedient to what God is saying. But often we get distracted. You know, the treasurer writes, and after every budget, we've got a gathering in 2 weeks' time, the letter goes out, explains the budget, and then invites the church to reflect and consider how you're going to respond. But you know how hard it is for us to fill in these forms and get them back. It's like, you know, it's 2 minutes or 3 minutes or, you know, maybe an hour of prayer and 2 or 3 minutes filling in the form. But we get so distracted. There seems to be so many other things. And the same with, you know, our use of our time. We think about giving our time, but then we get distracted. And we actually find ourselves intending to see God, intending to give, intending to get involved, but we never actually do. And we have to get disciplined. We actually have to see it through. We have to get resolved that when the treasurer writes to us, that we actually take the time to pray. And as I say, if God's saying your level of giving is right and appropriate, or even that you should reduce it, that's fine. But I just ask you that you take the time to be disciplined to reflect on it. The second problem we have is how we relate to money. And Paul talks about this, about this whole idea of balance. You see, money gets a grip on our lives. And I was reading a book called Wealth and the Will of God, and it talks about this, and it talks about a phenomenon, an epidemic that's probably worse than the coronavirus, which he describes as affluenza. And he says this about affluenza: for the foreseeable future, the quality of social and cultural life will more than at any other time in history be linked to growth in material life, both publicly and personally, nationally and internationally. I expect that the leading intellectual, emotional, and behavioral issues of the day will revolve around the detriments, dilemmas, and dynamics of personal decision-making in an age of affluence. He's saying, the key question that we face today for most of us, and I know the students are going, oh, we don't have any money, but you guys do, is how you're going to spend your money. How are you going to relate to your money? This is the key decision for a 21st century audience. And you know, some people don't have those decisions, but most of us do. And some people think that, you know, life is for living and money is for spending. I have a friend and he's a disaster when it comes to money. Anytime he gets any money, he feels he has to spend it as quickly as possible. I don't know if he's worried it's going to get stolen or whatever. But he has to. This week he told me he had just bought 3 hot tubs. And I was like, you live in Scotland. Why have you bought 3 hot tubs? I said, oh, I'll sell them. But I know the truth is they'll stay in his garage and just rot there. But he has to feel like he's spending money. And it's like, I want to send him to therapy and say, you need to work out what's going on in relation to your therapy. Your therapy, your money. Others of us have a kind of poverty mentality where we think that we never have enough. You know, I've sat down, and sometimes these are hard conversations pastorally with people who have assets or even incomes that relate to the millions, and I'm not exaggerating here when I say this, relate to the millions, and they still feel that they don't have enough. And I find it really hard to kind of relate to that mentality, but they've got an issue. You know, how can I give to the church? I just don't have enough. But there's a fundamental problem that we have in our relationship to money. And often at the root of this, what is lacking is balance and proportionality. Proportionality, we're not actually giving in terms of the resources that we have. Sometimes people don't have many resources and they give beyond what they should be giving. But sometimes people have large resources and they aren't giving in the way that they should be giving. And for us, we have to, with that, but there's also balance. You see, we sometimes get things out of sync, and that balance, as I say, we oscillate between this kind of aesthetic austerity, and we move to this in self-indulgent excess. And we find it hard to kind of, you know, find a middle path. So we're always needing a better phone. We're always needing a better computer, a better car, a better house, a better... And we never actually achieve an appropriate balance in our life. Paul uses the illustration of collecting manna in the desert. And he said, you know what? The children of Israel were provided for by God. And ultimately, all the resources that we have are provided by God. And he said, you know, some of them thought, if we go out and collect more, we'll have more provision. And it'll be really good. And we can keep it for a few days and it'll be great. And you know, in the story, what happened to that manna? It started to stink and it was filled with maggots. You know, I've seen people and I've known people who are very wealthy. And I've known people who use that money for the sake of God's kingdom. And I know people who have tried to keep hold of it. And those who have tried to keep hold of that money, often I find, are miserable. I find you miserable. And I realized this one day. When we lived down south, there were folks that we knew, friends, that their annual bonus, and again, this is in the dark ages, so this was a lot of money, their annual bonus was £300,000 a year. And you were like, wow. And they're in their 20s. £300,000 as your bonus. That's not your salary. That's just your bonus. And we would sometimes go out for meals with them. They take us to really nice restaurants. By the way, I like going to nice restaurants, just so you know, okay? And we go to really nice restaurants. And it was a miserable experience. And I was like, this is weird. You see, for me, going to a nice restaurant was a big occasion. Because, you know, we'd save up and we'd maybe do it every 18 months or so. And it'd be like a brilliant, wow, we got to a nice restaurant. Wasn't that food amazing and everything? But for them, they were doing it every other day. And so all that happened was the meal today is not as good as the meal we had yesterday or the meal. And everything never quite made. And suddenly life lost its joy. You know, that's the maggots and smelling because there's not. And yet the power of money to change is quite remarkable. There are kind of three stages that we can talk about. Efficacy, which is a qualitative change. This is like moving from not having a home to having a home. From not having a car to having a car. From not being able to afford clothes to being able to afford clothes. And you know, as Christians, we need to work towards seeing this kind of change in our culture. Then there's qualitative change, and it just changes the enjoyment. So instead of driving that wreck of a car, suddenly you can drive something that's a bit nicer. And the qualitative experience changes. Soon car driving is not about getting from A to B, but it's about enjoying the driving experience. You know, and suddenly we have qualitative change. Now, here's the thing. Qualitative change can get very out of hand. Now, you can have a £10 bottle of wine or a £100 bottle of wine. Now, again, great debate. Is a £100 bottle of wine better than a £10 bottle of wine? Probably is. But here's the thing. How much better? And does anybody really notice? You know, and suddenly we have qualitative change to the degree. I love A.W. Tozer. He says, you know, rich people still have to put on their trousers one leg at a time. A lot of wisdom in that. But here's what happens once we get qualitative change out of sync. We start to get attitudinal change and we start to get a spirit of entitlement. A few years ago, I'd been playing golf up at Glen Eagles. I didn't pay for it. I'd been taken out, but it was lovely. It was a great day. Lovely, brilliant fun. We went back and we were sitting in the dormy house and we were enjoying some food. And, you know, we were sitting there. We'd had a great day and it'd been wonderful. It'd been really, really nice. And somebody in the course of that moment turned around and said, I wonder what the poor people are doing today. At that juncture, I had to go to the toilet. Because I think if I said what I wanted to say at that point, I would never be asked to play golf with them again at Glen Eagles, and I quite wanted to do that. But I was so angry. And I just thought, you know what? What has become of our attitudes in terms of our relationship to our money? And that's what starts to happen. I'm somebody because I have money. You're nothing because you don't have money. There is no place for this kind of entitlement in the body of Christ. And here's the question that I think Paul would ask us in terms of balance and proportionality. When is enough enough? You know, when is your house big enough? When is your car good enough? When is your phone okay? When is enough enough? I have known people who have had millions of pounds and they still don't think they have enough. Who don't think that they can release money. You see, when we have abundance, when we have excess, it means we must regulate the way we use our money. That's what the manna principle is. It's saying you have abundance, so regulate what you have. And let me say, it is a self-regulation, okay? Sometimes Christians and sometimes people hear sermons like this and they start to judge the cars that people drive or the restaurants that people go to or, you know, the houses that people live in. There is no room for that within the Church of Jesus Christ. If people are honoring God in first place, then, hey, it then becomes a matter of self-regulation for us, where we actually say, God, when is enough enough? And God, I'm appropriately using my energies, my time, and my money in a way that honors you, but also doesn't degenerate into an aesthetic thing that says I can't enjoy a game of golf at Glen Eagles, or I can't drive a nice car, or I can't live in a nice house. But nevertheless, I honor you, and I regulate my abundance with proportionality and balance. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I thank you for the challenge of Paul's words in Corinthians. And I just pray that as a church, as we face the challenges that we're having to deal with and the things that we're grappling with, Lord, I pray that you would just guide us through these things. I pray for every one of us that you would address our hearts and that we would have right attitudes in terms of giving. And Lord, you would also address our regulation and use of money and time, that we would operate with true balance and proportionality in every aspect of our life. I ask this in your name. Amen.